The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Oh, wasn't that a great talk? And coming up, we've got beaming in from Western Australia, Karen Hall. She contacted us, lovely, lovely woman, as she wanted to share her story about being stuck in Western Australia, locked out of New Zealand due to the COVID restrictions and mandated to get vaccinated. Since returning to New Zealand, Karen has co-founded a Facebook group, Parents Against Gender Education. Well done. And she's amassed 3,000 members. That's something else. Oh, my goodness. Karen, good morning.
Good morning, Rodney, and thanks for having me on.
It's so lovely, and listeners don't appreciate this, but producer Dave and producer Bex have just had multiple heart attacks because we had those moments where we didn't think we're going to have you because it was like the technology was failing and we're live. And I'm thinking I've got to talk for an hour. But here you are, right on time.
Right. Yes, couldn't come through on the laptop for some reason, so I'm on my phone.
Well, it's working. Now, Karen, I do want to cover gender theory and what's happening in our schools and what you've done about it, because that is a subject near and dear to my heart. But yes, we'll get to that. First up, we'll deal with that other subject dear to all our hearts, COVID.
Yes.
Where does it start for you?
Okay, so I had moved to Australia in 2018, late 2018, and I was in a small mining town in WA, Kalgoorlie. You may have heard of that. Quite an isolated town. It's nearly 7 hours of drive away from Perth.
Oh, I can't imagine it. You're sort of in Western Australia and you think, oh, it'll be just down the road. It's 7 hours.
Yeah, so it was a
Is that just in a bad car or are you driving at speed?
That's, you know, I think 110 was the speed limit there. So, yeah, it was a long way. So we're
And what were you doing there, Karen?
So I was working as a disability support worker. I'd actually gone over there on holiday to start with a friend and yeah, ended up moving over there because I had this job and opportunity. And it was a really awesome old school community. Very friendly, loved it, loved my work. I was on good money, you know, everything was going really well.
Just back up the truck a little bit. I'm fascinated by this. Were you a disability support person here in New Zealand before you went to Australia?
I had done it. I'd actually was working at Kmart, and I've been there 11 years, and I was doing a bit of disability support work on the side. So I sort of started getting into that, and I transferred to Australia with Kmart and got really screwed over when I got there. And after being there 11 years, I had to start from scratch again.
So you're 11 years here in New Zealand. You went to Kmart Australia. They expected you to start from scratch. And was Kmart Australia that you went to, was that in Kalgoorlie or somewhere else?
Kalgoorlie, yes.
And what does a disability support person do?
So we do all sorts of things. So there's group homes you can go into where you're doing everything, you know, the personal care, the meals and taking them out to the appointments and taking them out, you know, to do things in the community and that. And then there was others. I worked with a lot of young people with autism and those that lived at home, you know, you take them out in the community and do things with them. And it's, you know, a lot to give their families a break during the day. So I had many clients with many types of disabilities and, yeah, you're just supporting them to live, you know, as normal a life as possible and do the things for them that they can't do for themselves.
Did you love it?
I loved it. I loved it there. I had wonderful clients I became very close to, and their families, and the agency I worked with was fabulous as well. Yeah, it was a great experience.
It's the strangest thing to me in my life that I became Minister of Special Needs, and I couldn't imagine anything worse than, it sounds so terrible about me, but I couldn't imagine anything worse than like these poor kiddies and having, what could I do to help? It's so sad and so tragic and so miserable. And then I walked into a classroom, and to this day, it was the most beautiful classroom I've ever been to in my life. I've never seen such learning. I've never seen such joy and happiness. I have never seen such beautiful teachers. And every moment I got as a minister, I would visit these schools, including mainstream schools. And I loved it. In fact, when I left Parliament, I seriously thought about training as a special needs teacher or assistant.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Because the joy.
It is. They're so happy. You know, they so want to be happy. And when you pick up a client and you just give them a good day, you know, you make them smile and you make them happy, and it's just so rewarding. And you're right. They learn so well. They're so eager to learn. They're eager to please. And they just make the most of every minute of the day.
And at the same time, you feel so blessed about your abilities that you take for granted.
Absolutely.
And you look at the courage and the effort that these little kids, in my case it was children, effort that they have to do just sometimes to climb up and sit on a seat that you take for granted. Oh, so good for you. Because it's just, I never expected that feeling. And so when you say that, if you'd said that to me before, I would have said, what the heck, how can that be? Are you disabled yourself?
No, I'm not.
Mm.
It's really eye-opening, like, at first, because it was suggested to me by a friend when I found Kmart wasn't going to give me the hours I needed. And, as soon as I went to apply for the job, yeah, everyone was just so friendly. And the clients, like, I just felt such, you know, I can't even explain it really, the relationship with the client. Oh, just in my heart, every single one of them, in my heart and forever. And, you know, adults as well, a lot of them were non-verbal. And so just how they communicate with you and how you understand them, it's just, yeah, indescribable. It's absolutely indescribable, the relationship you form with these people.
I went also to see businesses that were taking on these young students to give them work experience. And I couldn't believe going into like a tyre repair business. It's a little wee business struggling to make a living. And they take on these kids and look after them and give them experience and trying to get them into the workforce. And you think, it's very easy to be down on people. And then you see the wonderful efforts that people do. Don't have to do it, but they do it for love.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's such a lesson in humanity.
Oh, yes.
Mm. Sorry, yeah, Karen, that was a diversion. But it's so wonderful. And I mean, I would have thought special needs teacher, what? You know, it's wonderful. Tell me, special needs support person, disabled support person. So, Nick, you're doing that, loving the job, happy where you're living. COVID comes along. Tell us then.
Okay, so at the start, you know, I believed that, you know, what was happening. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, you know. And then after a little while, you know, when they were talking about where it came from and stuff, and I sort of started wondering, you know, how did this just suddenly appear everywhere all over the world? You know, I started thinking, you know, this has got to be man-made and spread.
Oh, wow. You were early on.
Of doubting. And then when it came out that it was from a bat from Wuhan, I was like, oh, my God, please. You know, I just thought, oh, no, something's going on here. And I had there was a very good friend of my son's who right from the start was putting up Facebook posts saying it's a load of crap, you know, and on. And we thought she was crazy at the start. We thought, oh, my God, she's lost the plot, you know, da, da, da. But she was actually bang on, and she picked it up immediately. So, yeah, then, you know, I started looking into it more, and, of course, it was all over social media, and I realised what was going on. And where I lived in Kalgoorlie, because we were so isolated and everything, the whole thing didn't affect us at all.
Of course.
We didn't have any there. I think there was two cases, one of the backpackers where they went into lockdown for 10 days or whatever, and then those people were left, and there was a road worker who'd come from Perth, and as soon as he tested positive, he would send back to Perth. Apart from that, we had none in the community. And so we were just going about life as normal. And I think, you know, at one stage the bars got closed down and the restaurants and stuff got closed down for a bit. But apart from that, we were only wearing a mask to go to the doctors and stuff, but we were just going about our daily lives. And I was seeing all what was going on in New Zealand and also in Australia, particularly Melbourne. And when the lockdown came in New Zealand and the borders were closed and that really started freaking me out, because I was then locked out of my own country.
Unbelievable.
And I started watching what was going on in New Zealand through social media and the convoys and the Freedom Village and all that. And, oh, wow, it just hit me really bad. I just wanted to go home. My adult children were having issues with being locked down, with not being able to work, with kids not being able to go to school. So my daughter couldn't go to work. So there was a whole lot of financial issues going on. And, yeah, where I was, nobody was like-minded like me around everyone.
Man, that's amazing. So you were literally on your own.
Yeah, I had no family there. And, yeah.
And everyone around you had no one there who would think you're on the money.
No.
Wow. Didn't
even talk about it. And when they were talking about bringing, you know, trying to get a vaccine together, they were all patiently waiting, you know, can't wait for this vaccine. And I was not into it at all. I was just, what the hell is going on? And I just wanted to get out of there. I just wanted to go home, and I couldn't go home.
I can imagine. Tell me just a quick question, which I ask myself and ask others, and I don't know the answer. What was it, do you think, about you that set you apart in Kalgoorlie, however you say it?
Kalgoorlie.
Set you apart from all your friends, your colleagues, your neighbours, everyone in the town? What was it that made you think differently?
I think one thing is I'm just not that person. I'm not a sheep. You know, I'm not one to follow others. I've been more individual all my life. I've not gone and done what, you know.
Isn't that funny?
Had social contagion sort of thing.
Yeah.
I've always been a bit of a loner, and I've never been afraid to say that I think something's not right or something's stupid, or no, I'm not going to do that, it's dumb. you know. I've
just, and it's deep within you, right?
Yeah. So I didn't just fall for it and believe what mainstream were telling me. I was questioning it because it didn't sound right to me. It didn't
And people like you and myself and our listeners, we are so different in every possible way that people can be different, in a great, wonderful way different. But we have this characteristic. And COVID brought that out in us, and you couldn't do it.
No. It was just so many alarm bells and red flags.
So you wanted to get home, wanted to be with the family. And, of course, as soon as I remember, I got locked up one night in London in a jail cell. And as soon as the door went shut, you'd think you'd just say, oh, well, I'm here for the night. I might as well just wait it out. As soon as the door was locked, I just wanted out.
Yes.
And so the fact that you can't go home makes you want to go home. That's part of our personality too, probably. The fact you can't do it, you want it. So it was, you wanted to get home but couldn't.
Yeah. What really freaked me out about it was with the speed with which it happened.
Yes.
Like, suddenly I had no control. You know, suddenly it had just happened and there was nothing I could do.
And no one cared.
And no one cared. And there was nowhere you could go. You know, everyone trying to get home, you know, for funerals or whatever, they were refused.
Pregnant. You're pregnant trying to get in. And she was a tyrant.
Yeah, she was. She was terrible and just lies and just blatant and just, you know, the whole thing of being lied to like that and controlled. You know, you're absolutely controlled, losing your control. So,
but she was smart in this sense.
Yeah,
and she's now on the lecture circuit. She works at the UN. She flies around the world. She goes to see Prince William. She gets knighted. She gets a damehood. I don't think she could readily travel back and walk down the street in New Zealand because there'd be people abusing her.
Never will she be able to walk down the streets.
No,
in New Zealand.
I would go up to her. I wouldn't abuse her because she's a woman. But I'd go up to her and I'd say, look, I just got to tell you something. I couldn't stop myself.
Exactly, me neither. But, yeah, and we were all, you know, at that time, as you know, it was all about waiting for announcements of announcement. You know, it's going to be an announcement about this and an announcement about this announcement, you know, and it was going on like that. So then I was just, you know, really watching, you know, apart from on the news in Australia, seeing what going on in Australia, social media was my avenue to see what was really going on in New Zealand. And it just broke my heart, just what people were going through when they brought in the mandates and they started trying to jab everybody and they were bribing them and they were outside schools and just that whole scene, just I would be in tears. I was just so desperate to go home. And I liken it to, like, you know, back in the war when the soldiers went off to war and they wanted to go, you know, they were anxious to go. They lied about their age and everything to go to war to defend their country. And you sort of wonder, why would you want to go when you can die? You know, sort of, but that was a feeling I had.
You wanted to get back and fight for your country.
Yeah, I wanted to fight for my people, and I just felt that need so intensely. And to be watching, you know, the convoys and the Freedom Village and all of that and just wanting to be there so bad, and I couldn't get home, and they had that MIQ in place and the lotteries for travellers, which was just such a sham. That was ridiculous. That was the most unreal thing, and it was really hard to try and work out how to get in the draw for that. And when I finally did, the time I went in the draw, because you had about half an hour, I think, noticed that they were going to do it. And when I went, and it shows it live, you know, people coming on, there was 30 something thousand people from all over the world trying to get to New Zealand, and there was only 4,000 something rooms available in the MIQ. So So you had better chance of winning lotto. And people were on there, it was their 11th time, their 12th time, and I just saw, you know, I didn't want to do that. And I was trying to get home because I knew we were going to get mandated for the jab, and I did not want to get jabbed. And I was trying to get home before I was mandated. But as it progressed, I had to be jabbed to be on the plane anyway, and I couldn't get home through the MIQ system. And then we were waiting for announcements of when the borders would be open, with, you know, and when we could go home without going into the MIQ. So that just drove me insane.
I bet. Just
trying to even match up flights with your MIQ and all that sort of, it was just mental. Like, it was just mental. It was so traumatic. And even though I was seeing all these people, you know, in the rest of Australia who were leaving their jobs, you know, they were living in their cars because they didn't want to get jabbed. They weren't doing it. They were scared. They didn't trust it. There was all this information coming out about the myocarditis and all that sort of thing. And we knew it wasn't safe. And so, you know, just the whole thing, I'm watching alone from afar, you know, and it was just, it was so hard. And then,
were you still working then?
Yeah, I was still working then, but I knew it was coming, the mandates. And also the clients were all had to be jabbed. Otherwise,
so if you're autistic, nonverbal,
exactly,
you can't give consent.
Exactly. And I had an incident where, so to go to the doctors or anything, you had to have a, when the, you got, they got the rapid tests, you had to be tested. Oh no, it was before that, the PCR. Yeah, to go to the hospital. Oh no, sorry, I'm just trying to think. So I had a client, he's nonverbal, he was an elderly man, he'd been beaten and he had brain damaged and he was quite paralysed in a wheelchair, and I loved him. I loved him, he was the most awesome guy. And he was at the doctor's because they thought he had a chest infection, and another client, another worker had taken him to the doctor's, but she was finishing her shift and I took over from her and met them at the doctor's. And the rules were then that if you had anything chesty or breathing, you had to be tested for COVID. So he was then sent to the hospital. I had to take him to the hospital for a COVID test, otherwise he wouldn't be treated. And when they got there, when we got there, we were put in this room, isolated. Now, remember, there's no COVID in Kalgoorlie. The borders are closed and nobody can get there. So we are put in this room for ages by ourselves, didn't really know what was going on. And then they come in to test him with the bloody cotton butt up the nose. And he, so they didn't even tell us anything. We were just told to wait in this room. Then they come in with all this stuff and started the stuff together. And then they're going to shove this.
Terrifying for the poor man.
Yeah, he was.
Oh.
He was, And
he wouldn't have been able, with his presumably incapacity, to even understand COVID and what the hell.
No, not really. You know, he could understand your brain things, but
yes,
he had no idea.
Not the big picture.
Of what had been going on. You know, he had no idea probably about anything about COVID, probably hadn't been told anything about it. And so I had to quickly try and explain to him what was happening, and they held his head.
Oh, like dear God.
And shoved that up his nose
because
he
was
fighting it. And then we had to wait 3 days for the results. So they, they then gave him medication, I think, for his chest infection and sent us off, and he had to isolate for 3 days waiting for the test. Well, he lived in a group home with four others. So I get it out of the hospital. They just shoved us off. I said, well, he lives in a group home. You know, what am I meant to do? And they said, well, it's up to your employer. They should have something in place. You just need to go. They just wanted us out. So get outside and I load him into the van and I ring my boss and tell them what's happened. And they had no preparation, didn't know what to do. So
of course.
And we just had sit there, and it's blimmin' hot in Kalgoorlie. We get 40 degrees heat. And we had to wait while they sorted his group home off and could section off an area for him to isolate. And it was just insane. And, of course, you know, he didn't have COVID because how could he catch COVID? And
but it's cruel and unusual punishment.
And, yeah, and when the mandates did come in, they vaccinated all the clients. Otherwise, they weren't providing care for them if they weren't vaccinated. And I was luckily I wasn't asked to take any of them to have their vaccinations. Other staff must have did it. I don't know if maybe office admin did it or something, but there was no way I would have done that. And but since then, he has died. That one, that was after I left, but he died last year, and I know he would have been vaccinated and boosted and everything. And also another one has died that I know of, and also a worker, a coordinator who she had other health issues. She was on dialysis for kidneys and stuff, but she actually died of a heart attack. So, yeah, it was pretty sad knowing that.
There's a lot of coincidences amongst the vaccinated.
Yes. But I was home by then. But, yeah, what happened is we did get mandated and I did not want to have it and I argued against it. I wasn't going to be able to work. And, of course, I'm in Kalgoorlie. There's no government assistance for New Zealanders financially.
Mm.
You know, renting a house, paying off a car. You know, I had debts and everything. I wanted to come home. Anyway, I fought against it and I just hoped, you know, that it would all change before the date in which I had to have it, which was first one I had to have by the 30th of November 2021. I had it on the 30th of November 2021. The cut-off date was the 29th and I didn't do it on the 29th. And then I got hauled into the office and everything and told, you know, I wasn't going to be allowed to work until I had it. And so I went and had it the next day, not happy about it at all. And that was traumatising in itself, knowing that I then had that in my body. I'm still waiting for the borders to be removed so I can go home. So I actually booked a flight then for the following February, just in case, because I thought when the borders do open, everyone's going to be booking flights and I probably won't be able to get one. So I booked one in advance, which I knew would get changed. But I went and did that, and then I was just hoping I'd be able to get home before I had to have the next shot, which was required by the 1st of January. So, no, it didn't. Borders not open, so I ended up having that next one on 31st of December. I had the second one. Not happy about it at all. Seeing all over social media, all the people who are having reactions and everything, it was really traumatising and I was really scared. What I was most feared was that if something did happen and I died there, my family can't get to me.
No.
No one can get, I'm there alone with no family, with no money. My kids cannot get to me and the trauma they're going to suffer. You know, all that sort of thing was going through my head. So even though, you know, I wasn't affected by lockdowns and stuff, it was just so traumatic being alone there and having that happen. And I had a very close family member die at the time as well. She died on the 7th of July 2020. I wasn't able to go to her funeral. And so I couldn't even grieve because I had no one to grieve with. And her daughter was in Perth. It's my niece. And I went over there and they live streamed her funeral. But I couldn't grieve because I was being a support for her, you know, and the family. And so to this day, I've never grieved that death. It's something I can't even face. I can't even think about. It's just in me. And, yeah, I've never actually grieved that, but that affected me hugely as well. after the first jab, I had an incident where I ended up in hospital. I felt I was just really unwell. It just had come on very quickly. I was with a client and another worker, and I suddenly felt really ill. I went pale. I went all numb on my arm, my left arm, and I was having, felt like palpitations or something, and the other worker with me took me to the hospital, and I was put on an ECG in there. I was given one of those little pills you put under your tongue to stop heart attacks, and I came right, and they said that, you know, nothing came up on the ECG and that, and after they observed me for 24 hours, and then I was sent home, and I was okay after that. Don't know what that was about. You couldn't, you know, we knew the doctors were all gagged then, and it was all safe and effective, so you couldn't query anything.
No.
But after the second one, I think it was, on the second jab I had on the 31st of December, I ended up in hospital again on the 28th of January the following year, 2022, and I had a client, and the same sort of thing happened again. And I was driving, and I had this non-verbal autistic client in the back of the car who's a runner. He runs away if you take your eyes off him. And I thought I was going to pass out, and I thought, God, you know, I kind of got him in the car. And it's a very small town, but I was really close to the hospital at the time, and I was closer to there than work. So I went to the hospital, and I just felt like I was just going to go. I went to the hospital, I locked him in the car, ran inside, told them what was happening, rang my work, and told them he's in the car, and I said, I'm going to need to come now and get him there, like 10 minutes away. And then, I was admitted, and coordinator come and got the keys and took over from my client. And anyway, I was put on, monitored again with all this stuff. And I had this really great doctor, and I was where I was in the A&E. So there's a whole row of people in there, like it is when you go to A&E and you're under observation. And she told me that. She said, oh, that's strange. Everyone in here is here for the same thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh really?
But it's not strange at all now, is it?
No. I didn't know a lot of what was going on at that stage. I was just sort of learning about the side effects and stuff, and what people were suffering. And then anyway, she monitored me. And then later on, she was finishing shift and another doctor came in, an Indian doctor came in. And he had my chart and he was looking at me and he was saying, no, everything's fine. You can go home. And she said to him, no, no. And he's going, yes, that's fine. And she said, no, but there's, and then he took her out of the room, and I could hear them standing outside arguing. And she was saying, no, but it showed something or other. I can't remember the word now. And he was saying, no, it's okay, it doesn't matter. She was going, no, no, no. And then I saw him storm past the room. He stormed off shitty.
Wow.
She came back in and she said, sorry, she said, there's just a little, can't remember the word she knew. She said, everything looked fine, but there was just one little thing that's worrying me.
And she was a nurse.
She was a doctor.
Doctor.
So taking over her shift. So she was doing a handover.
I see.
Yeah. And she said, I think it's okay. She said, but I just want to get it checked. And she sent me for a nuclear scan after that. But that came back clear. But that was just two things.
And how's your health now, Karen? I'm speaking with Karen Hall, who was in Western Australia in the COVID terrible years. How's your health now?
I've been fine.
Great.
So I heard, and then as time went by, I realised I came to see through social media it was the boosters that were really getting people. I found, I thought, there's no way I want that. I'm going to have any more, I was really traumatized then, and I just so wanted to come home. And it got to the stage then when I was meant to have another jab in, well, I can't remember the date now, in 3 months, yeah. So it was March I was meant to have another jab, and there was no way I was going to do it, and I was really freaked out because I thought I just couldn't be without money, you know.
Of course, you've got bills.
Yeah, but I found I'd only needed the 2 jabs to fly, so I thought, I'm okay there, I can get on the plane. And, yeah, just waiting for the announcements of the announcements. Meanwhile, the Freedom Village is going in New Zealand, and I'm watching the footage of police attacking everybody, and that whole scenario, I'm just in tears all the time. My son went down there, so I knew it was all real and true, and I knew the mainstream were just lying, and just watching that whole thing was just so, so traumatizing, and just wanting to go home. And then, yeah, on the last day of the, oh no, one stage when the police were beating everyone, and there was the young boy Alexander, who we saw the pictures of. The cops were holding him down and pushing his head into the ground.
Wasn't that disgusting? And
that really got me, because that kid looked a bit like my grandson.
Mm.
It was just a little bit younger, and doing that to the children, and that could be my grandson, and I cannot get home to protect
my. And it's our New Zealand police doing that.
Yes. And that just really traumatized the heck out of me. I was just bawling. I was just in a real mess over that. And, yeah, then finally they announced they were opening borders in February. So lucky I'd booked that flight. Yeah, we were mandated. And I just changed. You know, it changed me. You know, I had those 2 episodes in the hospital, but health-wise, I've been fine since then. I've had little palpitation things in the past, but it never led to anything, and that hasn't happened for quite some time now. But my mind, you know, it's just so messed with my mind that I had this stuff in my body now, and anything could happen, and still it does today. But also, I was just really angry then. It just
And you were forced to have it. You had no choice.
No, I had no choice. And, then it just ruined my whole work life as well, because I was angry, and I was angry at my boss.
Of course.
Angry running off and getting it. And I was angry at the fact that there was no COVID in Kalgoorlie. The port closed, nobody could get in. I was of no risk to anybody, unvaccinated. Our clients were of no risk to anyone unvaccinated, and yet we were forced to have this put into our bodies against our will.
Disgusting.
And that, I couldn't get my head around that.
Even if they were safe and effective, it's still disgusting.
So, yeah, how can they make me do that?
Mm-hmm.
How can they inject me against something I can't get? You know, and I said to them, you know, if there is community, you know, if there's another case in here, because the other's got sent away, if we have another case in this community transmission, okay, I'll do it. But don't make me do it until there is it, because I'm no risk. But they wouldn't, because it was all enforced, you know. And meanwhile, in Victoria, Dan Andrews was the equivalent of Jacinda Ardern.
Well, you know? He was even worse, I think. He was a jackboot dictator.
Yeah, seeing all what was going on there was just doing my head. You know, I was really freaking out.
But
I was really, really lucky, but it was weird. I was really lucky in Kalgoorlie, because we basically had life normal apart from that, and others didn't. So I didn't suffer, you know, not being allowed out of my home and all that sort of thing. We were still free to wander around. So it was really weird mixture of feelings. But anyway, you know, it's a really long thing, but you know, to cut to the chase, I ended up being able to go home without going into quarantine.
February 2022.
I ended up, and the flights got all changed. That in itself was a nightmare. But I came home on the 5th of March. But the process of that was, my flights kept getting changed. and where I'd have to, they'd change it, so I'd have to fly to Perth, stay a night, fly to Sydney, stay a night, and then go to New Zealand, and then it would all get changed, and I'd have to go to Perth for a night and then go to Melbourne for a night and things like that. And then I was trying to book extra baggage because I was moving home, and that in itself was a nightmare that I won't go into too much, but it took me 19 phone calls to Qantas where I would wait to get through for 2 to 3 hours and then be on hold numerous times, be about an hour and a half trying to. There was all this problem with me adding extra baggage. It was going to cost me $450 for an extra bag and all this sort of thing. And then I find that the flights they'd given me didn't match up and all that. That was a big, long story, and it was an absolute nightmare where I nearly went insane, ringing Qantas every single day, spending hours getting told different things, trying to arrange an extra bloody suitcase and get my flights to match up. I also had a vehicle that I was still paying off, and my daughter said she'd have the car and take over the payments for that. She was in Brisbane, so I had to transport the car to her, so I managed to fill the boot up with my extra stuff to get that on the transporter to go to her. And in the end, when finally my flights got changed the last time and they brought them forward 3 days. So appointments and stuff, an arrangement of them making 3 days later, I had to change, and one of those was the transportation of the car. So that was a nightmare as well, because we're in Kalgoorlie. We're miles away from anywhere. You can't see people come and pick your car up. And but luckily I got a really good guy who accommodated me and come and got it early. And
what was it like arriving back in New Zealand? You'd left pre-COVID and you arrived sort of post-COVID in that sense that it was no longer so locked down. What was it like coming home?
It was weird getting home. Like, just back up a bit, because I also had to have a PCR test 24 hours before I got on my international flight. And I had to fly to Perth first and then to Melbourne. I had to spend the night in Melbourne. So you had to have it 24 hours before you flew the international. So that arranging that, you have to have an appointment as well. So I'd arranged to have that test that would work in with that. And then they booked it in. You have to book it. And then I got an email saying due to the large volume of people coming through, they couldn't guarantee that appointment, and if I couldn't have that, I couldn't leave the country. But anyway, I ended up, so that was a nightmare, and that went on for a couple of days, but I ended up getting that appointment. But they don't give you the results for, I can't remember, 48 hours or something, so I didn't get the result of it if I was clear until I was at the airport to leave. So you don't know.
It's designed to break you, right?
Yeah, you don't know if you can get on that plane. So I'm moving.
And you're jabbed. You're all jabbed up to the gills with two jabs.
And they advise you to make other accommodation preparations in case you positive.
The money. The money alone is stressful.
I'm moving. I've got nowhere to go. I'm at the airport. I have no home. I have no job anymore. I've no family in WA. And, so that was just, drive you insane, I tell you. Anyway, it all went well. I was negative, of course, because I came from somewhere where they didn't have any COVID. But they were happy to send me, on my flights. This is what got me with the changes of the flights and trying to do these overnight things and stuff. You're sending me somewhere I might get it. I'm going somewhere.
Oh, you're okay. You were vaccinated. Oh, haven't had the booster. You'll probably get sick and die.
Talk about insane. Anyway, I got home finally, and it was just emotional getting to the airport. And my son was there to pick me up, and I'm home. God, I didn't know if I'd ever be able to get home. And it was just terrifying being over there, seeing that this could happen. And also, in that process of flying and that, you didn't know if the rules were going to change and we're going to go into lockdown again, because that was happening all the time as well. So, it was awful. But I got home and the relief, and I'm home, and I was sort of prepared. I was lucky because the disabled guy I had started looking after on the side in New Zealand before I went to Australia, his mum is absolutely fabulous. She employed me again straight away. I walked back into that job, but on a more full-time basis. So I had work as soon as I got home. I didn't have to have any more jabs.
And had New Zealand changed?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, everything had changed. People had changed. There's this big divide now. There's this, you can't trust anyone. We've got this tyrant bloody trying to kill us and control us. And there's been so many families that have come apart, friendships destroyed through this division and the fear and terror. And it's still going on there, you know, when I got back with them trying to vaccinate everybody still, and people are still giving up their jobs. You know, we had the nurses, the doctors, and the whole thing. Yeah, it was for quite a while. I just stayed home. I didn't catch up with people. Mm. I just couldn't deal with it for a while. I had to adjust and I had to settle, and I couldn't explain what I was feeling, you know, and everything. You know, going through it, when you go through something that traumatizes you so much, you can't just talk about it, you know. You're still dealing with your feelings and trying to put it all together.
Very much.
In your head, so for a long time.
And you had the extra difficulty that you were only observing what was happening in New Zealand at a distance.
Yeah.
And weren't able to share it.
No. And that final day of the Freedom Village as well, when they got attacked and brutalised and beaten and the whole camp was destroyed, that had me in tears. That was really hard to watch and not be there. That was, you know, I just wanted to be there so bad.
It was our war, wasn't it? We have come through a war and it scarred us deeply.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was nothing I could do to stop it, but I just wanted to be there. I just wanted to stand beside my people, you know. And that was really, really hard to deal with. So, okay, you know, when I got home, I was just really traumatised about that, what had happened there in my country, and now I was home, and just what people were dealing with, because a very good friend of my son's, the one that actually first called out the COVID pandemic, she was there on that last day, and she was really traumatised by it, you know, and just those people going home after that and the treatment they received and just that whole thing, yeah, that was a big, big thing for all of us. And, since then I've just been really angry, anti-everything, not trusting everything. And then, of course, I got into the, the gender issue, which we talked about, and started Parents Against Gender Education. And it's just the change in New Zealand is all these things that words, it's all about language. They destroyed our language and have made it mean different things and have changed the meaning of things like be kind. You know, that's a red flag for me now. That's
yes.
Not a good thing to say. Rainbow is not a good thing for me. I do not like rainbows.
Pride, you know? Pride remains the deadliest of the deadly sins.
Pride, yes. And
diversity, equity, and inclusion.
All those things.
They trigger us.
Yeah. So, yeah, and all those words and narrative and everything through the scamdemic called Jacinda's bloody things she said. You know, they're all triggers of anger and fear and tears. So
tell me this. I just had this interesting thought. What would you say, you're standing at McDonald's and Jacinda's standing in front of you? What would you say to her?
to be truthfully, if she was there, I would attack her.
Wow. Physically.
There's nothing I could say. There's nothing I could say.
You would
say.
Physically attack her?
Yes. There's nothing I could say.
My wife is like that.
I can't think of anything that I could say that would express
wow
what I really want to say. I would attack her. I wouldn't care if I went to jail.
Have you ever physically attacked anyone in your life?
Oh, I had a few fights when I was a teenager.
Yeah, but like it's not a thing that anyone else would have. You're not No one else, apart from some of these COVID tyrants like Dan Andrews and Ashley Bloomfield, no one else would. I mean, it's not a common thing that you'd feel. My wife is the same.
No, but I would, because she deserves it. And, you know, when you get really bad bullies or we're like causing harm to others.
Wow.
You need to. Sometimes they just need a bloody good hiding, you know. That's the only way they learn anything.
Well, listeners, there you go. Is that how you feel? Wow, because I don't know what I would say. It just occurred to me, what would I say? I'd be so... I don't even know what I'd say to David Seymour, who I know used to know well, and I've interviewed him, funnily enough, and I couldn't bring it up because I knew I'd... If I started, I couldn't stop. Dave, as we lost Karen, we might have, oh, here we go, she's popped back in, there was just a glitch. They were talking to Karen Hall.
Sorry.
No, you're okay. Sorry. You're fantastic. Yeah, we've got you back. I was actually musing.
I had a call come through. Right,
oh,
yeah.
That's funny. Tell me quickly, because we're getting on in time, and just to tell listeners, you can text me at 2057, and shortly you can call me at 0800 2057 57. We're going to need those calls, maybe your reflections and experiences and what you would do if you found yourself standing next door to Jacinda. Tell us quickly, what got you into worrying about gender theory?
I've always been big on protecting children, and my line of thinking that went that way when I was at Kmart and I was a union delegate. Mm-hmm. And we had a sexual predator for a manager there. And I started a big inquiry that had him removed. That's another long story I won't go into, but all these young teenagers, because a lot of students work at Kmart part-time, and they were having odd things happening there. And so I became aware of children's rights sort of thing. And, when I got back and I was looking at the whole... social media, now of course you're suddenly being enlightened about all these other things coming to light, and this relationship sexuality education guidelines, this transing of children,
puberty blockers, hypersexualization.
Yeah, that sort of came on my radar, and it came through Rob Talkler, who I was following on Facebook, and he did a lot of lives. And we had a conversation, him and I, one day, and he told me of his friend, Blair Graham, who was fighting this among a high school, and asked I'd give him some support. I really knew very little about it at the time, and I went and met Blair, and I... read the REC documents and all its guidelines, became very knowledgeable about what was going on, and his group of a few other women and us, we formed the age group Parents Against Gender Education New Zealand. We attended board meetings and we fought this at Mangawhai School and actually got it stopped. We did petitions, we held public meetings. And because we saw their parents didn't know what was going on.
Don't know. Have no clue.
They were being deceived. The whole thing was very non-transparent. And boards, they were shut down by the Board of Trustees. They weren't being listened to. And there was a need for somewhere for them to go to get some help, to get some support, and to be listened to. And we started Page, and the membership grew there enormously, very, very fast. And the feedback we got all the way along was, oh, my God, thank God, there's somewhere I can go to talk about this. And, that took off, and we just supported people and joining them in their districts and in their school communities, and helped and supported them to have public awareness meetings. And we had Bob McCoskrie was very helpful.
He's great.
He had a presentation, and he would come to our meetings and present them. We also had Fern Hickson from Resist Gender Education came to Zoom. You know, we had a psychologist also who helped, but she worked for ACC, but she couldn't speak under her professional capacity. And, you know, and they were silent. Doctors were silenced. And this is a huge thing. It's a huge concern, and parents really need to start looking into
it. It's bigger than COVID.
Yeah. So,
do you agree with that? It's bigger than the COVID.
Yes, it is, and it's more dangerous. And
you and I are absolutely on the same page.
Yes, and children are being sexualized. This is all about normalizing the sexualization of children.
Yes.
And this gender stuff, which is obviously all a load of rubbish, but it's designed to make it normal, make insane things normal. We just accept them. We just, that's insane, but yes, that's how it is.
That's right.
And it's bringing up this new generation with that indoctrination, so they don't think like us, they don't query, they don't ask, they accept. And it's changing language and meanings, and from a cultural aspect as well, it's well embedded in there, changing the meaning of te reo words. It's just everywhere.
I spent time on it, and I read the curriculum for my 13-year-old daughter most carefully. Couldn't get it from the school. You have to buy it for $5 from what used to be family planning. I read it most carefully, thought about it, so horrified, read it again, thought about it, wrote an article on it. In thinking of it, it could only be written by paedophiles and people who want to destroy womanhood.
Oh, absolutely. And you've only got to go on Twitter to see these deranged men.
Yes.
And their sexual fetishes.
Yes.
And they are violent. And they go and speak of how they're going to kill TERFs, and how they're going to torture them and murder them, and how they're going to murder their parents, and the ways they're going to do it. I mean, it is absolute insanity.
And we have lovely teachers, caring, wonderful teachers and principals and boards, absolutely going along with it.
Yep.
And if I was to tell it, I think even my own daughter, yes, if I was to teach my own daughter at 13 what is in the curriculum, I would be rightly arrested.
Yes, you would. And this is a thing, you know, and we can't work out why there's not charges being brought.
No, and, I mean, listeners will be sitting there that don't know this, and they'll be thinking, no, Rodney's lost the plot. Look, there's no way to describe it. If you read Navigating the Journey for any year of a kid at school, which is in more than 50% of all schools as a curriculum, you can't read that and think this is okay or normal.
And also they're inside out.
Oh.
Their resources and that. Now, you're teaching minors about anal sex, about fingering, about... Now, this is real. This is what the material...
They came, without my knowledge, Inside Out arrived at Arrowtown Primary School when my daughter was 11, trans teenagers and non-binary, whatever, completely deranged looking kids, spent 2 hours with a class telling them how it was cool to be non-binary and trans. And as you say, they're teaching them at 11 and 12 and 13 how to have heterosexual sex and homosexual sex. Teaching them in the classroom.
No, my battery's going to go flat.
You go. Karen Hall.
I just want to say two things. It's frightening and it's not about being gay. So no. That's the umbrella and the rainbow that come over.
Absolutely.
We don't have lesbians and homosexuals coming into our schools trying to tell children they're lesbians and homosexuals. It's never happened. It's not happening. This is trans in your child and it's frightening. I also wanted to give a shout out to Manawahine Korero, who I am very close to, Di Landy, who's been on the show a few times.
Wonderful lady.
I think I've just got to charge us. Okay.
We will go, but what you realise, more gays and lesbians are speaking out. Because yes. What is happening, of course, is they're taking kids who might be gay and telling them you're born in the wrong body.
Yeah.
You need to take these puberty blockers. Oh, it's so terrible.
They've got to stop them from putting affirmative care where they're putting children on puberty blockers, because without going through puberty, they don't know who they are. You won't know who you are until you go through puberty. It's a natural progression of growing.
And who the hell I'm getting adulthood. I'm feeling like I've just walked in and met Jacinda, because this actually makes me aggressive too, but it's designed to make you aggressive. It's designed to make you a problem.
Yeah,
it is. If they were teaching my little 11-year-old girl, my gorgeous little girl, that she could be a boy and to think about it. Think about it. You know, do you think you're a boy? Do you think you could be? This is psychological abuse from the schools. And I go and see the schools and they think I'm nuts.
That's right. And Parents Against Gender Education, we have parents that I met with. So I've met with a few parents. And there's this couple in particular who really touched my heart. Their daughter was indoctrinated with this stuff during the lockdowns when she couldn't go to school. And so through the internet, she was a girly girl, beautiful. I've seen the photos, gorgeous, long, curly hair. Suddenly she thinks she's a boy. And now there's photos of her looking like a boy. And we had a meeting with Tani Ankovich from Family
Yes.
New Zealand First. It's the only one who's actually listened to us. And she met with us and we took parents, we took a teacher, and this couple who I'd met with and heard their story, because I've been fighting this for a few years now, they've spent serious money on psychologists and psychiatrists and counsellors trying to get help for their daughter, but they were only affirmed, and they've been told they're terrible parents. They've been told to leave the room and not being allowed in the room with their child and the counsellor or whoever, and they can't get any help apart from affirmative care. Well, they showed, the mother came and she showed the photos to Tania Ankovich and the rest of us that were there. There was about 8 of us. And honestly, we were all so close to tears.
Company.
It was so emotional seeing the photo, watching the change and hearing that story. It's frightening, and people really need to know what's happening. And just be aware, it's happening everywhere. And through Manawahine Korero and Di Landy, I've become aware of, you know, it happening everywhere else, in like the midwifery council where they're moving the words woman and baby, replacing it with whānau, you know, and the chest feeding because, you know, men chest feed. You know, all that
There's
sort of
a book, Welcome to Sex.
Yes.
And it says They don't call them little boys, little girls. They're vagina owners and penis owners. That's disgusting. Yeah. Karen, I have to move on. We'll get calls going. Karen.
Great talking to you.
Karen, bless you.
Bless you too, Rodney, and
thank
we're fighting this together.
Thank you so much for coming on our show. Your Facebook page is called Parents Against Gender Education. Have
New
a
Zealand.
Look. New Zealand. I'm in Let Be Kids, which is a sister organisation.
Yes, yes.
And we've got a fight on our hands for our kids like nothing else. It makes COVID look a picnic.
It does. This is our future.
Thanks, Karen. You're lovely.
Thank you so much.
It's Talk Back with Rodney Hine, right here on RCR. Call 0800 2057 57 and have your say.